Welcome to the 26th episode of the Hope Illuminated Podcast, your source for the stories, science, and strategy of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resilience, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Spencer-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I'm so grateful you are here. We're in for an absolutely moving and inspirational interview and conversation today with my dear friend and colleague, Sue Klebold. We'll be talking about moving through and making meaning out of an unimaginable tragedy, in her situation, a murder-suicide. And so we'll be talking a little bit about trying to understand the phenomena of murder-suicide and also how families, how communities can possibly move through that and even make meaning from it. And so just a little context for this. We are understandably very, very concerned about murder-suicide. It's a huge tragedy, leaving in its wake horror for many, many people. And we also know that of all suicides, murder-suicide accounts for about 2% of all suicides. So it becomes kind of this very confusing pathway for many of us involved in suicide prevention, because the main thing that we know that works in suicide prevention is compassion and listening and supporting and helping people through their darkest day. And yet at the same time, especially in the United States, we have a lot of fear about murder-suicide. And understandably so. When these tragedies happen to communities, there is an outpouring of horror and grief, and the media often covers it very differently than another type of suicide death. It's covered more frequently, a lot more details, and people often walk away going, how did this happen? How did this happen? And then we end up in these huge divisive conversations. The truth is there is actually very little research behind murder-suicides, and so we're still trying to figure it out, but we do know some things. One is, and I encourage you all to read this book by Dr. Thomas Joyner. You've heard me talk about him several times on this podcast. I've also had him. He was my very first interview, so proud of that. He talked about his book, Lonely at the Top, and particularly why men are struggling. And he also wrote this book, Perversion of Virtue, where he dives into this question about what is going on with people who suicide and murder someone else in the process of their suicide. And he came to the conclusion that for many, if not most people who are involved in a murder-suicide as the person engaged in both murder and suicide, there's what he called a perversion of virtue, which is that the person thinks first, so the suicide is primary. The first thought is, I am going to take my life, and then there is some kind of virtue that is twisted in their thinking that then leads them to think, well, if I'm going to kill these other people in my process. And I really encourage you to read this work. I'm not going to do it justice here. He is an incredible thought leader in so many areas, and he writes really, really well. The book, again, is called Perversion of Virtue, and he says there's really about four virtues that get twisted in the mind of the suicidal, homicidal person. One is about mercy, so that the thought process goes, well, if I'm going to die, these people can't live without me. And sometimes that's a mother and children, or sometimes it's an elderly couple. You know, I can't have these people live without me, so I kill them in addition to myself. Sometimes it's about justice, where there's a perceived wrong that's happened. So the thought process goes, I've been poorly treated, and I'm going to die. And so in my death, I'm going to right this wrong, and I'm going to kill these other people to tip the balance of justice. And again, all of these are grossly misperceived ideas of virtue. Some of them are around duty, and others are around glory, right? So if I go out and I know the media is going to cover this, I will always be remembered. So all of these are horrifically twisted virtuous ideas that sometimes get implanted in the mind of a suicidal person. But again, really only about 2% of suicides result in suicide. We're going to talk a lot today about also the grief process through this. As we've mentioned several times before on this podcast, the grief process for people bereaved by suicide, whether that's family, friends, coworkers, is often very complicated and protracted for a lot of people. So it's hard to navigate sometimes both the trauma and the grief reactions that we're having. But when we're talking about murder-suicide, all of this gets ramped up even more. So it's usually not just one loss that people are grieving. It's multiple losses. The trauma and the horror of the scene itself, of the implications, are really, really difficult. The guilt also gets much more exacerbated here, as well as the shame. And then there's tremendous amounts of fear that come with it that I'm very sure that Sue will be talking about as well. Fears of retaliation, fears of lawsuits, fears of all the complications of a media frenzy. And so we'll be talking about how Sue has lived through this and the things that she's learned about both bereavement and about murder-suicide and some of the great work that she's doing now. So I was really looking forward to this interview. I have known Sue for a long time, and I actually remember the moment that we met. It was in a basement of a church, I think about 2005, somewhere at the latter part of 2005. I had been going to this support group for survivors of suicide loss with my mom for several months. And she came into the room and she introduced herself. And, of course, we all knew who she was because of the story that had come out around the Columbine shooting many years before. And I was immediately struck upon first meeting her about how incredibly spiritually grounded she was, how articulate, how thoughtful. And I was very, very grateful to meet her and then over the course of the years to become friends. I also remember the first time that she publicly told her story. It was part of a conference that I was the chair of back in 2006 at the University of Colorado in the Boulder campus. And we had put together a conference on violence prevention in college campuses called Violence Goes to College. And she was part of a panel on murder-suicide. And again, her level of articulation, her transparency, her genuineness was a profound impact on the audience members. So she is the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of the two shooters from the Columbine High School shooting of 1999, who killed 13 people and injured more than 20 others before taking his own life. Since that tragedy, Sue has been unstoppable in her effort to really understand this critical intersection between mental health problems and violence. She wrote a book in 2016 called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And you should all know that all the profits of the book are going to mental health and suicide prevention organizations. So she's really giving back in a meaningful way. She's also on the Loss and Healing Council of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and she's a member of the Consumer Survivor Committee, along with me, at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We've also served together on the Colorado Suicide Prevention Coalition and in some other areas. And then just a heads up that coming up every November, the Saturday before Thanksgiving every year, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention hosts its International Survivors of Suicide Loss Day for all people bereaved by suicide. And so please look at the AFSP.org website to find out where a group is local to you. And please join other members of suicide loss to grieve together, to honor the life that was lived, and to build a network of support. So without further ado, it is my very deep honor and privilege to bring to you my friend and colleague, Sue Klebold. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sally. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, it is. And I'm very sure that even our international listeners have some familiarity with the tragedy of Columbine, but probably haven't heard it from your point of view. Take us back. Tell us a little bit about your story, how you experienced this tragedy from a mother's perspective.
Well, without going into great detail, I wanted to mention that my son and his friend, Eric, entered Columbine High School on April 20th, 1999, with the intention of destroying the school and killing everyone in it. And So one important factor for me that gave me, certainly if there was anything in this horrible story to have some gratitude about, was to know that they failed in their original intent. But they were armed with guns, and they entered the school and killed 12 students and a teacher, and wounded more than 20 others. And the actual count of how many were wounded is actually difficult to obtain, because in an event such as this, we count what is an injury differently. A visit to a hospital, if you tripped and fell while you're running and had to go to a hospital, is that considered an injury from the shooting? So there, in this regard, statistics are hard to keep. From my perspective, what I saw in the days and weeks leading up to Dylan's death was I saw a young man who appeared to be happy. I certainly not, bubbly, but grounded. And he was getting ready to graduate from high school. He was 17 years old. He'd entered school a year early. He had been in some trouble like 14 months before he died. He'd gotten into trouble at school. He and Eric had stolen something. There had been an arrest. They had gotten into a diversion program instead of going to jail, where they had counseling and support and community service. They were released early from that program because they told us that they had done an outstanding job, and they were doing by every account, very, very well. So when this happened, Dylan was getting ready to go to college. He had been accepted at four colleges, including the university of his choice. And a few weeks before the shootings, my husband and I and Dylan had gone on a college visiting trip in Arizona so that he could look over the schools that he was considering. In the few days before the tragedy, Dylan went to a prom with all of his friends. On that weekend, he sat at a computer with my husband. He picked out his dorm room for college. He measured the square footage of several rooms to try to find the biggest room he could. He, on the night of the prom, he came home and talked to me and told me that he'd had the best time he'd ever had in his life. And he thanked me for making the evening possible. So and when he was with his friends, he was talking about his future. They were talking about who was going to, get the hottest car, when they were going to get together again. So from my perspective as a parent and from the perspective of all of his friends, we didn't see any indication that anything was wrong, that there were any red flags. One of the most difficult questions that people asked me at the time, and it was so difficult for me to hear this, was how could you not know? And I wasn't able publicly to speak for many reasons, and to try to explain to somebody that preparing for one's future, talking about one's future, getting into college, these aren't behaviors that you would expect of somebody who is preparing certainly to die or to harm other people. So that
and
was
I'll just
our
jump in there for a second right there,
sure.
Because, we see these in all types of suicide situations, and I have come to the place where I believe in that moment those things are true for folks, and that there is kind of this, push-pull inside them, where on some days the will to live is stronger, and we are preparing for the future, and we are enjoying life, and we are seeing all the things that you just described. And that is truly how they are experiencing their life in that moment. And then in other places, there's this dual life piece that's happening where it is very dark and it is very hopeless. And it's not that people are faking it. It's just that which horse is ahead in that moment. So thank you for sharing that. Keep going.
Well,
yes,
and thank you for those
more
comments. And then that's very helpful for me to hear, because in the years and years since this has happened, I've asked myself in a million different ways, how could you do this, Dylan? How were you able to do this? And I think you're right that in certain moments they believe that things are going to get better, and in certain moments they are preparing for their own deaths, and they are in a very different place.
So then what happened?
Well, when this actually happened, on the morning of the shootings, My husband over that weekend, of the prom weekend, had said to me, does Dylan seem tense to you or different? And I said, no, why do you ask? And he said, well, the pitch of his voice is slightly higher than usual. And his voice goes up like that when he's tense. And I said, well, I didn't notice anything about that. And I said, maybe it's because, you know, he's never been to a prom and he was going to go with all these friends and they were doing a limo and going out for dinner. And I said, maybe he's just nervous about that. You know, he's never done anything like that before. And Tom said, well, maybe that's what it is. So the morning of the shootings, I was getting up very early to go to work. It was dark outside. House was pitch black. And I was the first one up, and it wasn't time to wake Dylan yet. But I heard him bounding down the stairs past my door, because his bedroom was upstairs and mine was on the main level. And I thought, what is he doing up this early? And I leaned out my door and yelled into the darkness. And I said, Dill? And then he didn't answer, and he continued to run down the stairs. And then I heard the front door open. And all he said was, bye. And he slammed the door and was gone. And I thought, that is really odd. That's just so odd. And I, you know, of course, my wheels are turning. I'm thinking, is something wrong? Why is he up so early? Maybe he's meeting somebody for coffee. Maybe, you know, I was not in anywhere thinking that this could be a life and death situation. It was just, This is different. This is odd. And I said to my husband, did you hear the way Dylan just said goodbye? And he'd been asleep, and he said no. And I said, I think you're right. Something is bothering him. Will you be here to talk to him when he comes home from school? And he said, yes, I'll be here, because he worked out of our house, and he was always there when Dylan got home. They always had, you know, they would read the paper, talk about sports. They'd have a snack. It was just certain that they would be together. And he said, I'll talk to him, and I'll figure out what's going on. And I said, that's great. And then I went on to work thinking that whatever it was that was bothering my son would be handled appropriately and that everything would be fine. It was not a red flag, that something I carried with me all morning. I totally forgot about it. And then at noon, I was getting ready for a meeting. I had to go out of my office and go to a college campus. I was away from my desk, and when I got back, there was a message on my phone from my husband, and he sounded like I'd never heard him before. He was breathless. His voice was quaking, and he said, Susan, this is an emergency. Call me back immediately. And I called him back. And he sounded nearly hysterical. He said, listen to the television. And he put the phone up against the TV. And my mind is racing. I'm thinking, what in the world could be happening to upset him so much? And the only thing I could think of, something's happened to one of our children, because nothing would upset him that much. But when he said, listen to the TV, I thought, well, maybe we're at war. Maybe our whole country's in danger. And I'm, you know, trying to get him to come back on the phone, and I'm yelling, what is it? What is it? And then he got on the phone, and he just spewed out all of this information. There's a shooting going on at the high school, and the gunmen are wearing trench coats, and, you know, and Dylan's friends don't know where he and Eric are, and you know, he was just tumbling. And something was wrong, and very, very wrong, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. I didn't know if Dylan was... He said, you know, the police think Dylan might be one of the shooters, and I just stopped him. And I said, I'm coming home right now. And I got in the car and drove home. And that began, you know, years and years of horror. And with the police coming to our house that day and SWAT team and us being evacuated, and the story goes on and on.
Wow. And so I just want to go back for a second because, I mean, you did pick up on signs that something wasn't quite right. And again, very much like in other situations around suicide, they're coming through vague. They're coming through, as you said, this is odd, this is different. Maybe he's just tense. And, you know, again, without having all the other information that you discovered later, it's understandable that you say, okay, well, maybe he is going through something, and attribute to the things that you know, the prom, end of school, transitioning into college, whatever it was. You did the best you had with the information that you had at the time. And then my heart, every time I've heard you tell the story several times, and every time you tell it, my heart just sinks on that moment that you got the call and how your wheels start reeling. And I can't even imagine what the rest of the day and the years to follow were like for you. Tell us a little bit more about kind of your thought process on that day as you're trying to figure out what was happening.
Yes, and before I do that, I wanted to jog to the side a little bit and say that Dylan was a graduating senior who had been accepted at college, but we did get a call from the school about 3 weeks prior to his death saying that his grades were starting to slip, and one of his teachers asking if we could come in for a conference. And I'm adding this here because in the realm of not only suicide prevention, but the prevention of mass shootings and murder-suicide, there were some important signs that were touched on that night that none of us recognized as signs. And number one, the math teacher told us that Dylan doesn't act like a typical graduating senior. And he said he's been sleeping in calculus class. He said there's just something about Dylan that's different. Now, he was the only one who said that or mentioned that. And, of course, I'm saying, well, you know, he's going to college. They told him he would have to take calculus over. Maybe he's just blown it off. And I explained that he'd already been accepted at school. And, you know, we thought, well, maybe this is senioritis. He's just deciding that he doesn't have to work so hard. And another thing that occurred during that meeting was we spoke with his English teacher, and she said, Dylan has written a paper that is very, she used the words dark and she used the words disturbing, but she didn't tell us what the paper was about and she didn't have it there with her to show it to us. And I remember all three of us, my husband and I and the teacher, being somewhat perplexed about the paper. And of course, I'm there. I love to write. I love the arts. I'm saying, well, isn't a paper that's dark a good way to express one's feelings? Isn't that a healthy thing? And, you know, look at the movies that kids see. Look at the music that they listen to. And, you know, and we were wondering, and my husband said, is this something we should be concerned about? And she said, I don't know. And we sat there for a moment in silence, and then she said, I know. I'll ask the school counselor to take a look at it and see if he thinks something should be done about this. And then I said, and you'll call us back? And she said, yes, I'll let you know if something is needed. And we never heard anything about it. I asked Dylan to see the paper, and he told me it was in his car and told me he'd left it behind, and I forgot about it. It was one of those things that just disappeared off the radar screen. Nowadays, if a child mm-hmm. writes a paper that is, and the paper was about murder, which was not mentioned at the meeting, that is a red flag that the kid mm-hmm. may be struggling, and that would have been enough to alert a threat assessment team, an intervention where someone might have done a suicide screening or a screening to see if there was violent thought. But at the time, people didn't recognize it, and I years later talked to the counselor who said, I said, what did you say to Dylan about this paper? And he said, well, Dylan was such a nice kid, such a low-key kid, it didn't occur to anybody that he could be dangerous. And he said, I said to him, you know, what are you doing? You know you're not allowed to write papers like this with bad words in them. And he said, I know. And he said, well, don't do it again, okay? And Dylan said, okay. So mm-hmm. I wanted to take that journey to say that when there are
really
signs,
important.
We may not recognize them as signs, but they may be signs. And that was an example of the school being in the same stage, the same phase of naivete that we all were back then. So
now
I'm ready to talk about whatever it was that you asked me, and I'm hoping you'll go back and re-ask me so I can
just
go on that
a little
track.
Bit more about yes, a little bit more about your thought process on the day of the call, kind of, you know, what you were thinking, what you were, you know, how you were coping, what was happening.
That when on my way home that day, I remember I was shaking, I was frightened, and my mind was like a tornado. It was whirling. It was First of all, I thought maybe there's some kind of a prank, and maybe Dylan and Eric had gotten involved with something like that, and it went bad for some reason, you know. So, you know, because it mentioned guns, and we didn't own any guns, and I had no idea where guns would have come from. I thought maybe they were wrong. It isn't really Dylan and Eric. Or maybe they were confused and Dylan was actually hurt. And then I'm thinking maybe he's wounded or maybe he's lying somewhere and needing help. And I was going, just trying, my brain was trying to logically explain these little pieces of information and connect them so that they made sense. And I was absolutely convinced that Dylan couldn't have planned anything this because he had been talking about his future. He was going to college. None of this fit. None of it fit. And I was just, you know, seeking understanding. And of course, I would be doing that for months and years to try to seek understanding. But on that drive home, it was just racing thoughts. And I would cry and I would not cry. And I didn't listen to the radio because I was wanting to use every faculty I had to try to stay on the road because I had to drive 26 miles home. And then that day I got home and it was just chaos. My husband said the police are coming. You know, he had found an attorney for Dylan because Dylan had just gotten off of diversion, and then they'd learned that Dylan was a suspect, and you know, police came to our home. We were asked to sit outside all day and not allowed to go inside our house because they suspected there may be explosives in the house. And it was just a long day of weeping and confusion and terror.
Unbelievable. And, you know, those first few minutes that you talked about where your brain is working in overdrive to try to make sense of the unfathomable. That is also true in so many other types of tragedies, and we will create a narrative. And to the outside world, sometimes it seems like that doesn't make any sense. But our brain is trying to really put together some details in a way that makes sense to us. And again, that's a very normal reaction to some very abnormal situations. So then what happened next in your journey?
Well, the actual day I got home that it was somewhere around 1 o'clock, and that particular day we sat outside on the ground in cars because there was no place to sit in the front of our house, and we weren't allowed to go into our home, and we waited. I just remember sitting and waiting. I remember talking to an investigator who was asking me questions about Dylan and he was very stern and very very unsmiling. I felt accused. I felt just, you know, somehow I was being held responsible for something that was happening. I wasn't even sure what was happening. But throughout that day, I remember asking again and again, "Where's Dylan? Is Dylan okay? Is Dylan okay? Is he alive? Is he, you know?" Because I didn't understand the magnitude of what was happening. I heard on the radio that 25 people were dead, which turns out to not be true. But I just didn't know what was happening and didn't understand what Dylan's role in it was. And finally, in the late afternoon, I did. I turned to one of the SWAT team guys who was there, and I said, "Is my son dead?" And he said, "Yes." Mm-hmm. And I said, "How did he die?" And he said, "I don't know." And then we had to stay there and just wait and wait. And helicopters were going over, and crowds of people were gathering. Cars were parked along our road. And it was as if we were in a fishbowl. Everybody wanted to get a look at this family that, you know, spawned this perpetrator, whatever was supposedly happening. And I just remember sitting on the ground and crying a lot and asking questions. And finally that evening, they said, "You're going to have to leave your home, and we're going to bring in a bomb squad." And I thought, a bomb squad? What are they talking about? I mean, none of this made sense to me. We didn't own guns. We'd never had anything like that. I felt like I was in a nightmare, and I just couldn't wake up.
Wow.
And then, you know, and we had been in touch with an attorney that day because we had thought Dylan would need one if he had done something wrong, because he'd been on a diversion program. And they told him, if you do anything, even shaving cream on a banister at school, you know, you could have a felony on your record. So, you know, he was instructed to not slip up. So, you know, we couldn't understand, well, how could he be involved in something like this? And we had to find a place to stay. We didn't want to stay at a hotel because this was the biggest news story that had hit the country, and so, not within my lifetime, but it was one of the biggest. And
the world. It went global very quickly, because in that time it was, you know, the biggest murder-suicide situation that had come to public consciousness, I also remember. And I also, you know, let's put this in perspective. This was 1999, you know, many, many years ago. We kind of live in a different world now where this is much more commonplace. I also want to just talk about the fact that support group where I met you in 2005, was that your first effort to go and get any kind of grief support, or did you do something before that?
One of the complications of being a murder-suicide survivor is that it's a legal situation. There are murders involved. And because Dylan was a minor, he was 17, there were lawsuits involved. And very quickly it became clear that we were going to be sued by everyone involved. And ultimately we were sued by 36 families. And because of lawsuits, the one thing that happens is that people don't speak to each other. They're not, you know, they're advised not to by their attorneys. That's one of the things that happens in a community that's so unfortunate when one of these shootings happens, is that immediately everyone starts suing everyone else, and that's what happened in our community. So no one was talking, no one was putting together pieces so that you could develop emotionally and try to handle this. And I was advised not to go. I was told, actually, you know, don't go to a support group. And I desperately wanted to be around other survivors of traumatic loss because I needed that personal support. But I wasn't allowed to go because if our case actually went to court, then anybody that I had spoken with, and that would include members of a support group, could be subpoenaed. They could be asked to testify in a trial. And no one wanted to re-traumatize lost survivors anymore by exposing them to that. So I was not allowed to go to a support group until all the depositions were over. So yes, it was about 5 or 6 years after the shootings that I finally walked in the door of a support group.
And so how did you manage to live through that time, Sue? I can't even begin to fathom how to do all of the things that you needed to do for yourself emotionally. Oh, and I should also point out that Klebold is a very identifiable name. You know, there are many, many Harrises, but you rarely run into the last name Klebold. So everywhere you went, every time you pulled out a credit card, every time you did anything that involved your name, people would recognize you and connect you to this tragedy. How did you survive those first 6 years? What did you do?
You know, I often ask myself that question because I don't know. I remember it felt like I was in hell. That's the only feeling that our family has used to describe those years. We were afraid to be recognized or identified. If we would go to a grocery store and pull out a check or a credit card, we didn't want anyone to know who we were, because everywhere we went, it was very possible that we would be speaking directly to someone who had lost a loved one or whose life had been personally impacted by what our son did. When it was time for me to go back to work, it took me weeks to be able to go back to work. I had gone immediately into therapy, but that was just barely scratching the surface of all the work that it would take to rebuild my life. But having to go back to work and be in the same office with people whose children had to run for their lives, it was so humiliating. It was so terrifying. I was so heartbroken. I was heartbroken for all the people who had been killed and had lost loved ones and had had injuries, and the severity of their injuries were overwhelming, and I knew that they would have spend the rest of their lives dealing with their injuries, because I had worked with people who had disabilities, and I had some understanding of the impact that takes, that has on someone's life. I remember perpetually being in a state of, it is, with a murder-suicide, you have, double layers. One of the things you're dealing with is the traumatic loss by suicide of someone you loved doing something unexpected, and that they are gone from your life. And that was my son, my younger son, and I adored him, and I missed him, and I was, weeping for him constantly. But on top of that was this constant feeling of being watched, observed. I remember a huge amount of stress, thinking, what if I have a fender bender and I end up on the front page again? I was hyper-stressed at work. I was so afraid of saying something wrong or doing something wrong and offending somebody, or acknowledging that I was indeed the horrible person that people were saying that I was. Because I would turn on the radio and I would hear people talking about us and people saying that we were disgusting people and horrible parents. And our governor got on television and said to the nation that this was the fault of the parents. And so I was constantly living under extreme grief, stress, fear, terror. It was constant. And at about 4 years after the tragedy, and again at 6 years, I started having post-traumatic stress symptoms. I started having severe panic attacks and really became unable to function at one point, and had to eventually just take medication. So, yes, everything I could possibly do to hold myself together, to make myself well, I did. I mean, I surrounded myself with loved ones. I tried to put joy into my life. I remember I never used to watch TV, but I started every day like medicine. I would watch Seinfeld reruns and Whose Line Is It Anyway, because I felt that laughter released chemicals in my body that reminded me that it was something that, laughter was still a part of my life and my body still knew how to laugh. I had counseling. I did things. I tried to do things that fed my soul, to be with friends. I liked to draw. I tried to draw. I found that being in nature was helpful, so I started taking long walks. I used every tool I could think of to try to keep myself alive and well and balanced. And for a while there, I slipped out of balance and lost control, but I was able to find a way to put one foot in front of the other. Listening to other people, being with other people helped me. And eventually I began to learn that I could listen to their stories and didn't have to always be thinking and talking about mine. So it showed me that I was somehow, inch by inch, day by day, month by month, I was getting someplace. I wasn't sure where I was getting, but I could see that I was learning to live with that.
And was there a turning point for you, a moment when you had some clarity that you were going to do, you were moving through your healing in a place where you could contribute back? I call it my aha moment, in that same church basement, probably another year after I met you. I remember having this feeling like, you know what, somebody really needs to do something about this, and then going, oh, it's me, and that it was my life calling moving forward to, really dedicate my life to figuring out both suicide prevention and grief support for people bereaved by suicide. Did you have a moment like that, or a series of moments, and what did that look like for you?
There were, I would say, a series of moments. I had an image in my head of crossing a rushing stream on rocks. And each step of the way, I was thinking, okay, you've gotten to this rock. You haven't fallen in yet. You can get to the next rock. And I remember just feeling that, feeling very strongly. And there were many steps along the way where I thought, you could look back and say, you know, a year ago you wouldn't have thought this or wouldn't have been able to do this. One of the big, there were a couple of real turning points for me. One of the first ones was early on, we had gotten the coroner's report that Dylan had killed himself in this tragedy. And again, I knew nothing about why he was there, how he died, and what did that mean that he killed himself? Was that something he was forced to do? There was some talk about maybe his friend had shot him. One of the big traumatic but life-changing events was 6 months after the shootings, the police came out with their report and actually told us what happened, because up until that point I was completely in denial. I didn't believe that Dylan was capable of hurting anyone and that he had to have been there through some trickery. That was a huge turning point for me. And along with that became the realization that in reality his death was a suicide, and that is what I kept going back to, was why would he do something where he knew he was going to die? And we had confirmation in tapes that he made that he was saying goodbye. He knew that he was going to die. So being connected to the idea that his death was really motivated by suicide was a huge developmental step for me to help me figure out how one could actually do something like this. That was a big turning point. And I became more connected to the suicide prevention community. I began to think more about, what is someone's brain, what is happening in someone's brain when they are in a suicidal crisis, and how they lose access to their tools of judgment and reason and logic, and certainly in this case, morality. Another big turning point for me was an unexpected one, and that was when I was in the darkest times, and that was, I would say, it was when things were feeling pretty good, and I was beginning to think I could speak about this, and then I was set back by severe panic attacks and PTSD and obsessive thoughts, and I couldn't live my own life. I was stuck in my head, and I thought, this is going to kill me. It feels like my brain is now going to kill me. And I had already had breast cancer 2 years after Dylan died. So that was another thing that came up.
I should also point out that back during this time period where the murder-suicides aren't quite as frequent as they are today, every single time there was a murder-suicide, the Columbine case was brought into it. Often you received death threats during that period of time, and it was just like a reliving through it over and over years. For years that went on for you.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think at the six-year point, when I was so, I really was experiencing my own kind of mental illness where I couldn't get my brain to do what I wanted it to do. I mean, I would just be driving along, and all of a sudden I'd be in a car and be having a severe panic attack. And I remember thinking at that moment that I wanted it to stop. I just wanted it to stop. And I thought, if there had been a gun on the seat in the glove compartment, I really would have considered using it. And that was a time when I began to understand what mental pain really is and how it's not about anybody else. It's about your own suffering. And you want this to stop in any way that you can make it stop. And when I got myself back in balance after that, any day that I was not living in terror, any day that I could get through a day without having a panic attack, life started to look good to me, and I started to be filled with gratitude. And to this day, I still feel that any day that we are not in pain is a good day. And so that was a real turning point for me in my own journey, to be able to say, life has been hard, you've had a difficult journey, but you're not hurting at this moment. You're standing on a rock, and the stream is rushing by, and you're okay. You're okay right now. And I began to live my life very much in that manner.
And I also know that while it didn't always go well, you did make the effort to reach out to the families that had been impacted. How did that effort impact your journey, your process of healing or not?
Well, I think in some ways I realized that I had been doing to the victims' families what many had done to me, and that was I had been assigning to them who I thought they were, how I thought they should be. And what I learned was every one of these families, every one of the individuals in these families was different from everyone else. Each person was unique. So I wrote letters to all of the families who had lost loved ones and had injured loved ones. And I could see through the media that some people were angry and incensed and didn't read it. And then some people were kind about it and would say kind things. So it was, as everything had been up to that point, a very mixed bag of emotions and feelings. At that point, a couple of parents of two of the children who had been killed did reach out and did want to meet. And I was able to meet with them, and it was extremely helpful to me. I mean, we just, in both situations, cried. I mean, talked about our children, and it was so helpful. And yet there were others who were still angry and still judgmental and still projecting onto me what they needed to feel about me. And that was hard for me because, of course, we all want to be liked and respected, and it was very difficult for me to be judged and hated and not be able to do anything about that. So, but the positive was that in some cases over the years, I have become friends with some of the survivors of the tragedy, and they've become very touching friendships, and I value them, and I'm very grateful to those people who allowed that to happen.
Nice. And then when did you decide about the book, about really going very, very public with your perspective of what happened as a way to help the world really understand this at a deeper level, and also the people who've been impacted by this to have a shared story and some insights? When did that process start to occur, and how has that been for you in your journey?
Well, when I mention all the things I was doing to heal, all the things I was doing to help myself cope, I forgot to mention one important thing that I did, and that was journaling. I felt that journaling was one of the more helpful things I could do because I filled up dozens of journals in the years following this tragedy. And what that gave me was content so that maybe I wouldn't remember what I had experienced, but because I wrote it every day, I had a record of everything that I had been through, every feeling that I had. And there is part of me, because creativity is important to me. I like to do art. I like to write. I had never been a professional writer, but I'd written policy manuals at work, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I valued writing as a tool, as a creative tool. And all the way along, even from the very, very beginning, when this was happening to me, I remember thinking, because I had been a teacher, that I was about to embark on a journey and that I knew nothing about shooters, I knew nothing about violence and suicide, but that I, as a lay person, was going to learn and that it was my duty, my privilege, perhaps is a better word, to share what I'd learned. And so the idea of writing a book was always in the back of my mind because I was learning, and it is something that is important to me to share knowledge, to share what I've learned. The difficult thing about a book was I knew that eventually, if I ever published, I would have to be a public person. That was the part that really terrified me. I didn't want to be on television. I didn't want to be interviewed. I didn't want to meet the press. I didn't want anyone to know my face and recognize me. That's really the thing that took so long. It was 15 years after the tragedy before the book came out. But I had seen, and many, many people that I talked to, how knowing me changed the way they parented their own children. Mm-hmm. And there is a story about this in the book. And one of my coworkers had told me that she had a child who was suddenly acting, a 13-year-old daughter who was acting a little bit different, not terribly different, because 13-year-olds very often are struggling with a lot of issues, and they may not act as they did when they were younger. But because she knew me, she was more concerned and started trying to delve into this child's life to find out what was wrong. She asked repeatedly if something was wrong. The daughter denied it, and she pressed, and she finally got the daughter to admit that one day when she was supposed to stay home, she had snuck out to visit a friend, and while she did that, she had been raped on the street. Mm. So by sharing that story with me, it reinforced my belief that maybe people would parent differently. Maybe there would be things parents could do to try to help their children. And that kind of became my mission. And so when I feel intimidated and afraid, and I knew that I was going to have to be public, I just would put myself in that place to say, it's not about me. It's about what I can do to help others.
That's right. And you have been an unstoppable advocate ever since you stepped into this space. Can you talk about some of the things that you have learned about the science and the research that you've been able to connect with, and you know, how you are serving, not just through the book and your speaking, but on multiple boards and in multiple ways to help us move forward in all areas around suicide prevention? What are some of the things that you've learned?
Well, one of the important things, and I think I might have mentioned this earlier, was that with school shootings, the Secret Service came out with a report not long after Columbine. It was 2004. But in their research, they determined that 78% of school shooters are suicidal or have struggled with suicidality at the time of the shooting. So that was a big, big aha for me, because when you think about it, when there is going to be something as terrible as mass violence, people don't walk away from it. They are either killed on site or they take their own lives at the scene. Right. So, you know, there is a real strong connection there between this thought of mass violence. Because my situation was unique and others were killed and hurt, I was looking for anything that would try to save lives, and that would be not only the life of an individual who is suicidal, but someone with suicidal thinking who is also thinking about hurting other people. So some of these things that we see in brain research, for example, Dr. Victoria Arango's work with the brain and how she has identified that the brains of people who are suicidal are different from those who are not suicidal or who have died through unnatural causes, but not suicide. You know, it really helped me see that all kinds of factors are involved. These are very complex things that happen. It's not just that someone has depression, for example. It's not just that their brains are different. It's all kinds of factors. It's what they experience in their environment. Are there triggering factors, such as, in Dylan's case, bad experiences at the school, bullying, toxic friendship with someone who is extremely homicidal, that these things are very complicated. And one of my pet peeves is I will hear people say, for example, well, getting rid of guns is not the answer, or mental health is not the answer. And I always say, well, of course it isn't, because there is no such thing as the answer. There are many, many factors that contribute to this. And so I think by writing and speaking and learning and talking with all kinds of experts and people who have struggled in their own lives as well, it increases our understanding, and we need to do a much better job with all of the facets of this problem.
Wow. Well, we've covered quite a bit. Thank you so much for highlighting that, and I will be sure to highlight those reports on the page notes after we've posted this interview. I'm going to go through and do a brief recap of all the things that we talked about, and then I'm going to come back to you for some final thoughts if you have some strategy takeaways for maybe other families that are going through this traumatic grief process that you can sum up for folks. So we started off this conversation talking about, you know, while just 2% of all suicides are murder-suicide, it's really in the forefront of a lot of people's minds. I talked briefly about Thomas Joyner's book, The Perversion of Virtue, which I really encourage you all to read if this is something of interest to you. And then we quickly went into Sue's story. And again, her book is called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And she talked about how, you know, Dylan was really living a dual life. On one hand, he's planning for the future with a college endeavor and prom, and it's really hard sometimes for those close to someone to notice the red flags when what we see looks so affirming. But there were some subtle signs there, and of course, in hindsight, it's easier sometimes to pick up and make sense of those. And some are about just changes in mood, changes in behavior, like the slamming of the door and the pitch of the voice. Grade slipping certainly is an indication that something is not going well for somebody. And we have certainly learned a lot since 1999 when this has happened. I think in today's day and age, a paper that was about murder in the way that Dylan had written it would probably get a little bit more investigation than it did in that era. We talked about the huge trauma that occurs on the day that we get a call, like the call you got, Sue, where our world just completely is upended, and really what the brain does from that moment forward to try to fit the pieces together when things do not make sense, and how understandable it is that a lot of denial can come forward, again, not just with murder-suicide, but with all kinds of tragedy, as we really try to, you know, this make-sense mandate that our brain goes through. You talked about all the incredible complications of the grief process, the double layers of both the traumatic loss of a loved one, that yearning, that mourning, as well as extreme fear that people surviving murder-suicide often feel, both that, you know, there's tremendous repercussions here, as well as just living up to trying to prove to the world that you're not a horrible person every day with every single decision. I really loved your discussion about what you did, how you were really resourceful in keeping yourself alive with all the tools that you had in your toolbox despite all of this stress that was coming at you, including things that fed your soul, like art and nature and being with others, laughter, even counseling, journaling, and listening to other stories and really starting to connect their journey to yours. Your turning points in the making meaning, I loved your metaphor about crossing a rushing stream. You're just getting to one rock, and then you're getting to another rock. And the big turning point for you was realizing that the suicide was primary, that he was suicidal, and then he got connected in his vulnerable state to some of these other things, and that how that process, you know, in that process, people often lose their judgment, their morality, and a number of other things. And then you also disclosed your own suicidal pain, coming through all of the trauma, the stress, and your grief, and really connecting to your own sense of it's just about this overwhelming sense of suffering and how people can get there. People, though, at that point in time are not thinking about the other repercussions that their death might have on other people. It is really about I cannot take one more breath. The suffering is too great. You talked about some of your grief practices, and I do write often and talk about the rituals of grief, and one of your practices was to write letters to the surviving families and to the families that had lost loved ones, and how that's important in one level to connect with the humanity of these families and on another level to help you release some difficult emotions. And that the meaning-making process has been ongoing for you, realizing that, as you said, it's not about you. It's about how you are sharing the lessons that you've learned with other families. So maybe we do make some different choices around parenting or around policy or around all kinds of things that we're doing to try to get this to stop. And then, of course, we covered a little bit of the research about how the brains are different and how we're getting more and more information about all kinds of mass shooters, also living with various degrees of suicidal intensity. So there was a lot here, Sue, in your journey of making meaning. What are some of your final thoughts about things you want to share with others?
I think the biggest learning that occurred for me was that, you know, I had always thought I was a good parent. I had always thought my kids could talk to me about anything. But what I realized was that I never really knew how to listen. And so that is the one piece of advice I repeat over and over and over to people, and that is shut up and listen. As a parent, we are so uncomfortable when our loved ones are hurting, and we try to fix their pain, and we try to give them solutions and tell them that it's going to get better and give them hope. And if they say something like, you know, I'm stupid, I'm ugly, we always say, oh, I don't think so. I think you're pretty. I think you're smart. That in itself is denying their feeling, mm-hmm. and we don't realize it. What we're trying to do is help. So I feel that if I've taken any lesson from this, it is for us to listen and for us to not work so hard to help our loved ones feel better, but just mm-hmm. to sit in silence and help them feel, help them talk about what they feel. And I have true regrets, great, great regret that I didn't have those skills in talking with my own child. And the other thing I try to urge people is I believe that in this world, you know, we did not talk about the connections between the difficult discussion of mental wellness and violence, but there is much to learn around this, and we're going to have a lot of things we're going to have to work through. And I believe that everyone who works with kids, who works with anybody, should have at least a mental health first aid training, suicide prevention training, so that we are not intimidated when someone comes to us and they are struggling and they are hurting, to know that that doing something is better than doing nothing. And we can listen, we can encourage them to speak, we can connect them with resources if they feel that they are really struggling and hurting. It's something every one of us can do, and I think we've all got to learn those skills and do a much better job with them.
Wow, great. That's a really positive and powerful way to stop. Let's listen better and let's train ourselves better so that we are better able to deal with the situations when they come our way. Thank you so much for your inspiration, Sue, for your courage, for your honesty, your transparency. I'm so proud to call you my friend. You are doing some great work here, and I'm just so appreciative of you as a human in this world. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's a wrap. You're welcome. I hope you got a lot out of this conversation. If you want to listen more, that we have many, many podcasts at SallySpencerThomas.com. We have a blog there. You can also find more sessions on iTunes and on Blog Talk Radio. And we're really happy to get your feedback. So leave us a review, subscribe, and I'm very, very pleased to hear your comments about this. So until next time, open your heart, challenge your thinking, take action to save lives. Together we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.